Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 368, titled Hearken Unto Me, Part 2, The Ties That Bind, Part 5. What we're going to be dealing with in this program, which is a half hour in length and which is being recorded on July 15th of the year 2002, we're going to be dealing with some more of the connections between the terrorist milieu of Osama bin Laden, Al-Qaeda, the Al-Taqwa / Nada management milieu that we've looked at in various programs, 335, 336, 342, 43, 351, 352, 54, 56, 7, 8, 9, and 60 as well. The Al-Taqwa network has links going all the way back to the World War II period and to the Underground Reich, to the Muslim Brotherhood that we'll be speaking about. And it's one of the institutions that had its assets confiscated by the Treasury Department in connection with September 11th. What we're going to be looking at in this broadcast in particular is the Harkin Energy Company. That was one of George Bush's failed business ventures and has recently come into renewed focus on the political scene as a result of the sale of Harkin stock by George W. Bush at a time when the company's prospects appeared fairly bright, and then it turned out that they were very dim indeed. This has also entailed some of the same self-commerce, so to speak, or self-generating commerce that had generated false profits or false accounting in the Enron scandal, and this has become a major focal point in recent weeks as George Bush has railed against corporate corruption. He is shocked to learn that some of the things that have been going on have been going on. Now, in connection with Harkin Energy, pay particular attention to Talat Altman, who was not only a director of Harkin Energy, but was also a member with George W. Bush of the Audit Committee for Harkin. Talat Altman, also very close to Gait Faron and one of his proteges, that in turn connects up with the Bank of Credit and Commerce International. We're going to take a look also at Alan Quasha, last name Q-U-A-S-H-A. Quasha was also a member of the Harkin Group that bought out some of W's failed energy ventures. And we're going to take a look at Alan Quasha. We're going to take a look at his father, William, and the role that William Quasha played in helping to advise the Nugan Bank. That was a U.S. intelligence operation based in Australia that was involved in, among other things, covert operations, the destabilization of the Gough Whitlam Labor government in Australia. Nugan Hand also had some very strong connections to the drug trade as well. We looked at Nugan Hand in RFA, number 25, came back to it again in number 30. We're going to be taking a look at elements of continuity between the Nugan Hand Bank and the BCCI. Bear in mind that the milieu of the BCCI is inextricably linked with the milieu of not only September 11th, but to also the Saudi petroleum industry milieu that we've been looking at in connection with George W. Bush. Another branch of this financial and industrial nexus involves some of the financial connections that were generated between the American financial and business establishments and the Third Reich, and which then extended into the post-war period by virtue of the profound corporate connections between the American business and financial establishment and the Bormann Organization, about which I've spoken many, many times. By way of taking a look at Saudi Arabia and a rather concise and eloquent statement of characterization of the relationship between Saudi Arabia and some of the financial conduits that loom in the background of the connections that we're going to be talking about, specifically the BCCI. We're going to take a look at a recently published book, recently published in English, that is. The book is called Forbidden Truth. It's subtitled U.S. Taliban Secret Oil Diplomacy and the Failed Hunt for Bin Laden. This is a book that I've alluded to in, among other programs, For the Record 337. And For the Record program number 355, we took a look at it again in number 362. I would note that Islam bin Laden, the head of the Saudi investment company, the European financial branch of the Saudi bin Laden empire, successfully blocked portions of this book from publication in Switzerland. Recall that in 354 and 355, among other programs, we took a look at Baudin Dunant, the co-chairman of the board of SECO, and the fact that he represented Nazi financier François Genoux in his trial for terrorism in 1983. Baudin Dunant, as we looked at in For the Record 356 and 7, also very closely connected with the Clearstream Network. That, in turn, is closely connected with the milieu of the BCCI, Khalid bin Mahfouz, and the very powerful financial and business relationships, in particular petro-business relationships, that underlie the events of September 11th. And it is the frustration of the interdiction of those relationships which threatens a return of September 11th, or the events of September 11th. Now, the book Forbidden Truth by Jean-Charles Brisard, B-R-I-S-A-R-D, and Guillaume Dasquet, D-A-S-Q-U-I-E, published in softcover recently by Thunder's Mouth Press, Nation Books. That is copyright 2002 in English. The ISBN number is 1-56025-414-9. And the authors characterize the relationship between the oil business, the events of September 11th, Osama bin Laden, the failed effort against the Soviet Union in Afghanistan, which spawned Osama bin Laden as a warrior, as well as the Al-Qaeda milieu, and the relationship between the funding of Al-Qaeda and many of these powerful Saudi business relationships. That relationship, the connections between these elements, described by the authors as follows in Forbidden Truth. This kind of policy ensures Saudi Arabia's preeminence over Arab nationalism and over Iran in the promotion of Islam. This policy, by the way, is the funding of Islamic fundamentalist terror, or Wahhabism, or Islamofascism, as I've characterized it in the past. Continuing. It also keeps the West from entering into conflict with these radicals, who are supported by the leader of the Islamic world. It has been said too often that Osama bin Laden is a creature of the CIA, for the simple reason that the United States had contributed indirectly and temporarily, without a doubt, to his radical cause by financing and supporting the Mujahideen rebels against the Soviets in Afghanistan in the 1980s. But America's support for bin Laden was in large part the involuntary consequence of its own ambitions in the region. Saudi Arabia's support, on the other hand, was a calculated policy, clear and unambiguous concerning its brand of Islam in the world. Again, that brand of Islam is Wahhabism, spoken about in numerous programs, including For the Record 332, 361, and 362. Continuing. In light of these revelations, Osama bin Laden appears above all to be a product of Wahhabism and an instrument of the Saudi kingdom, and both contained converging elements that linked them permanently. The Saudi attitude toward the American response to the September 11th attacks demonstrates the regime's trouble with regard to Osama bin Laden. The kingdom's refusal to allow American forces to use its air bases in order to attack Afghanistan illustrates the mutual tolerance that exists between Saudi Arabia and Osama bin Laden. Saudi Arabia has yet to cooperate with the United States in its current investigations for fear of provoking fundamentalists in the kingdom. And Osama bin Laden was careful to spare the kingdom, even though he attacked its attitude in his early writings. We speak freely of state-sponsored terrorism, such as that of Libya and Iran, while Saudi Arabia is spared from the blacklist for the simple reason that it is essential in the international oil scene. Without this stroke of luck, it would probably appear high on the list. I would say there's no probably about that. Continuing. Osama bin Laden is only an emblematic figure in the major religious and financial issues and interests that underlie the future of even the Saudi regime. The networks that support him are well established, whether the BCCI, the Islamic banks, or the so-called humanitarian organizations, and it is quite unlikely that they will disappear with bin Laden. The real issue is elsewhere now, and depends on our capacity to call into question Saudi Arabia's political and financial support of the world's fundamentalist movements. It is a heavy burden, but if the West does not step in, such support will continue and take root permanently. We have long closed our eyes to this situation in order to protect the security of our Saudi ally, allowing the seeds of fundamentalism to grow and to become uncontrollable. We refrain from putting any kind of pressure on a power that still today defends the indefensible and allowed it to exist politically, materially, and financially. We've talked about the connections between the Wahhabi sect, between the Underground Reich, between the Third Reich and its above-ground period, and the genesis of the Wahhabi sect and its preeminence over Saudi Arabia, and the relationship with the Dulles, Wall Street, Bush financial milieu. Some of those connections, although many of the people have passed away, those institutional connections appear to be intact, and they lie directly across the national interest with regard to September 11th. I would also remind people that another part of Saudi Arabia's key power, aside from petroleum, is the fact that Mecca and Medina, two of the three holiest sites in Islam, lie within Saudi Arabia. So in addition to its economic power, it commands a tremendous amount of power over the Islamic world. And it is a combination of the petroleum power and the religious power of the two holy sites from Islam that places Saudi Arabia in the key position it is in with regard to the Earth Island, the giant landmass that stretched from the Straits of Gibraltar all the way across Europe, the Middle East, China, India, and Pakistan. That term, the Earth Island, was what the Nazi geopoliticians called it. Controlling that giant landmass was seen as the key to controlling the world. It contains most of the world's petroleum reserves, and across the middle of it is a giant stretch of Muslim population. From a very early period, the Nazis and the Third Reich began working in order to collaborate with and ultimately control that Muslim population in order to effect world domination. That collaboration continues to this time. By the way, Kevin Coogan's landmark article from Hit List magazine is now up on the web. I do not have the precise URL, but it is on the Autonomedia website at www.autonomedia.org. One can do a search. That is the Kevin Coogan article about Ahmed Huber, the Swiss, quote, neo-unquote Nazi and Islamist who is on the board of directors of Al-Taqwa. An individual who overlaps the Al-Taqwa milieu and a series of interlocking organizations that were raided by the Treasury Department on March 20th is a fellow named Talat Otman, last name O-T-H-M-A-N. Talat Otman was heavily involved with the BCCI milieu. Talat Otman is also, or was, a member of the board of directors of Harkin Energy and was on the audit committee that was engaged in some questionable transactions along with George W. Bush of Harkin Energy. We've taken a look at Talat Otman in For the Record 356, 357, again in number 361, and yet again in number 367. Talat Otman bridges a number of key and overlapping milieu here. Those milieu are Harkin Oil, again the milieu of Al-Taqwa, that of the BCCI, and in its background, as we shall see, the milieu of the Nugan Hand Bank. There was a recent article in the Los Angeles Times which talked about the Bush-Harkin dealings and mentioned the names of both Talat Otman and Alan G. Quasha, Q-U-A-S-H-A, a key member of the group that bought up Arbusto, Bush's failed energy venture, which morphed into Spectrum 7. They ultimately coalesced as part of the Harkin milieu. The following article is titled, Bush OK Deal Like Enron, subtitled, The SEC Rejected the 1989 Sale of Hawaiian Gas Stations by Harkin Energy Corporation, on whose board the future president sat. This article is by Warren Vieth, or Vieth, V-I-E-T-H, I don't know how it's pronounced. He is an L.A. Times staff writer. The L.A. Times published this on Friday, July 12th of 2002. This article is datelined Washington, and it reads in part as follows. In early 1989, George W. Bush and his fellow board members at Harkin Energy Corporation were presiding over a company that was headed south in a hurry. The Dallas-based oil firm had lost millions of dollars placing bad bets on commodity futures. Debt was piling up. Red ink was beginning to flow. Harkin's executives came up with a novel plan to ease that pain. They would sell a small chain of Hawaiian gas stations called Aloha Petroleum to a group of investors that included Harkin's chairman and one of its directors. The buyers would pay $1 million up front, but the accountants would record an immediate $7.9 million profit, enough to erase most of Harkin's losses for that year. They made a point of seeking the approval of directors who were not participants in the investor group. Bush, a member of the board's audit committee, signed off on the deal according to Harkin documents. So did the company's outside auditor, Arthur Anderson and Company. By the way, in addition to the fact that this deal was structurally identical to the shenanigans that Enron was involved in, note that Arthur Anderson was also the auditor for Enron. Note also, as we noted in For the Record 362, there is information that Enron had been working to broker the Taliban U.S. pipeline negotiations involving Unocal and also apparently involving Saudi Bin Laden Group, the Saudi construction company. These negotiations were aimed from Enron's standpoint at bailing it out, and it appears that the petroleum industry Taliban negotiations were known by Mohammed Atef, al-Qaeda's chief of operations, from 1998 on, and that the fact that mum was apparently the word was seen quite possibly by Mohammed Atef as a key that the plotters could go ahead with September 11th and not worry about interdiction. More about Harkin, Aloha, Alan Quasha, and Talat Atman. But the government challenged and ultimately overturned the accounting method used by Harkin to post a gain on the sale. Aloha was sold a second time, and the new buyer extracted big concessions from the company. The initial profit recorded on the sale morphed into a big loss. In the midst of all the maneuvering, Bush sold most of his Harkin stock in June of 1990. Based on a review of publicly released Securities and Exchange Commission filings, meeting minutes, memos, and correspondence from that period, there is no evidence that Bush or any of the other directors raised objections or expressed concerns about the Aloha deal. Experts on corporate governance say that as an independent director and one of only three members of the audit committee, Bush was in a position to exercise an important oversight role but apparently failed to do so. An audit committee's primary responsibility is to ensure that the company's outside auditors conduct a thorough examination of the financial records without interference from officers and employees. Skipping down. The Aloha sale was so similar to what Enron Corporation did to hide its losses that Harkin could have served as a model for the now-disgraced company, one accounting expert said. Again quoting, "The people at Enron could have gone to school on this thing," said Alfred King, former managing director of the Institute of Management Accountants, vice chairman of Milwaukee-based Valuation Research Corporation, and former advisor to the Financial Accounting Standards Board. "They sold to themselves and recorded a profit," King said. "That's exactly what Enron did on a number of those off-balance sheet transactions. On this one transaction, at least, it's almost identical," unquote. Skipping down. Still, accounting experts, security law specialists, and political analysts say there is enough similarity between events at Harkin and Enron to keep Bush on the defensive about his own actions a decade ago and undermine his credibility as a corporate reformer. Indeed, Bush would not have been allowed to serve on Harkin's audit committee if the reform proposals he outlined this week had been in effect then. The president says audit panel membership should be limited to outside directors. Besides sitting on Harkin's board, Bush had a consulting contract with the company. According to accounting experts, that qualifies him as a corporate insider. Quote, "Hiding losses in partnerships, playing games with accounting, not reporting forthrightly transactions as a potential inside trader, it's all eerily reminiscent of Enron," said Charles Lewis, executive director of the Center for Public Integrity, a Washington research group. Again quoting, "This is not a corporate executive who laid awake at night worrying about complying with federal laws from all appearances," unquote, said Lewis, who had been critical of the Bush administration. Another transaction at Harkin would have violated Bush's reform proposals as well. On Thursday, the White House confirmed that Harkin made two loans to Bush while he served on the board of directors, a practice that Bush now wants publicly held companies to prohibit. The loans, totaling $180,375, were made in 1986 and 1988 at a below-market interest rate to enable Bush to purchase Harkin stock under an incentive plan for board members. Skipping down again. Suspicions about the Aloha Petroleum deal have been fueled by the fact that most of the principals refused to talk. Of the seven Harkin directors who served on the board with Bush, five declined to discuss the deal or did not return calls seeking comment. Executives at Aloha, now a privately held company, also declined to comment. So did past and present officials at Harkin, Arthur Andersen, and the SEC. Former Director Talat M. Otman, who chaired the three-member audit committee, said he did not recall the details of the Aloha sale or the company's reasons for arranging it. Quote, "I'm not sure that our motivation was to create instant profits," unquote, said Otman, a Palestinian who represented Saudi investors who owned 13% of Harkin stock. Quote, "It was a normal part of the business to be buying and selling," unquote. The third audit committee member, E. Stewart Watson, also said he didn't remember much about Aloha. "I don't know about that Hawaiian outfit because I was getting off the board about that time," Watson said, skipping down. Harkin acquired Aloha in 1986 when it bought a multi-state gas retailer called EasyServe. When it announced its plan to sell 80% of Aloha in 1989, it said Hawaii was too far away from its other gasoline markets and required too much management attention. But the new owners looked an awful lot like the old owners. The buyers were an investor group controlled by the family of Harkin chairman Alan G. Quasha, and included another Harkin director, Jeffrey Lakin. Quasha, by the way, Q-U-A, S-H-A. Now, in the Wall Street Journal of Thursday, April 18th of 2002, there was a long article by Glenn Simpson, and this concerned the intercedence, or the intercession, of the aforementioned Talat Otman, a member of the board of directors of Harkin Energy, one of the people who was on the audit committee with George Bush, and someone who also sat on the board of directors of not only the Islamic Institute, but also an organization called the Amana Mutual Trust Funds. Talat Otman was an individual who has a number of connections with the milieu of Al-Taqwa and a group of overlapping organizations and overlapping financial operations that were raided by the Treasury Department on March 20th. We took a long look at this in For the Record 356 and 357. We returned to this subject again in For the Record number 367. And in the long annotated description on the Spitfire website for number 368, the documentation and the annotation will be meticulously repeated. Again, on April 4th, Talat Otman interceded with Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill in order to basically get the Treasury Department to take the heat off of the various organizations that were raided on March 20th. These organizations overlap each other, and there are a number of points of intersection between the milieu of Talat Otman and the milieu of Al-Taqwa. Now, the aforementioned Alan Quasha and his relationship to the Nguyen Bank, BCCI, and Harkin was discussed in an article called Bush Family Values. That was authored by Stephen Pizzo, and it was in the September and October 1992 issue of Rolling Stone magazine. Harkin Energy was formed in 1973 by two oil men who would benefit from a successful covert effort to destabilize Australia's Labor Party government, which had attempted to shut out foreign oil exploration. A decade later, Harkin was sold to a new investment group headed by New York attorney Alan G. Quasha, a partner in the firm of Quasha, Wesley, and Schneider. Quasha's father, a powerful attorney in the Philippines, had been a staunch supporter of then-President Ferdinand Marcos. William Quasha had also given legal advice to two top officials of the notorious Nguyen Bank in Australia, a CIA operation. After the sale of Harkin Energy in 1983, Alan Quasha became a director and chairman of the board. Under Quasha, Harkin suddenly absorbed Junior's struggling Spectrum 7 in 1986. The merger immediately opened a financial horn of plenty and reversed Junior's fortunes. But like his brother Jeb, Junior seemed unconcerned about the characters who were becoming his benefactors. And skipping down, it was also Union Bank, according to congressional hearings on international money laundering, that helped the now notorious Bank of Credit and Commerce International skirt Panamanian money laundering laws by flying cash out of the country in private jets, and that was used by Ferdinand Marcos to stash 325 tons of Philippine gold around the world. Union Bank played a prominent role in some of the operations behind Harkin. More. Through the Bahrain deal, the ties between BCCI and Harkin Energy grew tighter. Sheikh Khalifa, the Prime Minister of Bahrain and brother of the Emir, was also a shareholder in BCCI. And it was Khalifa who played the key role in selecting Harkin for the job. Sheikh Abdullah Baksh, in turn, was a business associate of BCCI frontman Gaith Faron. He bought a chunk of Harkin's stock and placed his representative, Talat Othman, on Harkin's board of directors. I would also note that there are some strong links, in addition to the BCCI Nugan Hand Harkin evolution that is discussed there. There is a very strong connection between the legal counsel that was involved with Nugan Hand Bank and also the genesis of BCCI. We're going to close on this note. This is from the book The Secret War Against the Jews, subtitled How Western Espionage Betrayed the Jewish People. The book was co-authored by John Loftus and Mark Ahrens, and it was published in softcover and hardcover by the St. Martin's Press, copyright 1994. Softcover ISBN number is 0-312-15648-0. Of the Bruce Campbell and Company and its legal representation of both Nugan Hand and Harkin, we read as follows. There had been a previous American attempt to use a financial facility for covert operations, but the Nugan Hand Bank operation was exposed by the Australian media and was on its way to bankruptcy by the late 1970s. The Nugan Hand Bank unraveled along with Wilson and Task Force 157, that's Edwin Wilson, but not before it had established close working relations in Saudi Arabia with both Aramco and the Bechtel Corporation. As the old bank in Australia collapsed, the new one in Abu Dhabi was coming into being with the help of the British Secret Service, which used the same front men in another British colony, the Cayman Islands. In this tax haven, Nugan Hand's legal firm of Bruce Campbell and Company set up the International Credit and Investment Company, or ICIC, as a front for the BCCI. That, again, from the book The Secret War Against the Jews by Mark Loftus and John Loftus, and Mark Ahrens. John Loftus, heavily involved in providing the documentation for the March 20th Operation Green Quest raid. So, again, note the name of Talat Othman, his involvement with Harkin, his involvement with the milieu of BCCI, and his intercession with Paul O'Neill, the Treasury Secretary, in that meeting on April 4th, in order to take the heat off of some of the milieu of the Al-Taqwa people. Note also Alan Quasha, his connections to Harkin, his father's connections to Nugan Hand, and Alan Quasha's connections to, again, the Harkin milieu. By the way, there will be a detailed annotated description of For the Record program number 368 on the Spitfire website, which will contain text excerpts and key annotations for all of the source material. Spitfire website, www.spitfirelist.com. Check the For the Record section. That's equipped with real audio. And be sure also to check two websites linked to, or two URLs maintained by sister station WFMU, which have all of the For the Record programs available on real audio. WFMU.org/Dave Emery has more recent programs available streaming. There is a longer URL as well. Again, Spitfire, P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, 95005. Email, mail@spitfirelist.com. And again, the real audio-equipped Spitfire website, www.spitfirelist.com. That concludes For the Record program number 368, Hearken Unto Me, Part 2, The Ties That Bind, Part 5, being recorded on July 15th, 2002. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.